things that enabled him to persevere. And the first was, keep the faith, which he said he meant in the broadest possible sense. It doesn't have to be religion, but for me, it was. I think there's a plan. The cross fell a few times. We had to pick it up. It's made my faith more relevant. It's made it more authentic. Taking Liam to church is part of a social vision as well. Every kid in our church is perfect, Paul said. They need to know that some things don't conform to the norm. Liam's one of them. Toward the end of the weekend I spent with the Donovans, Chris mentioned that she was feeling good about her New Year's resolutions. I asked what they were. You are part of it, actually, she said. I resolved to do things that I'm afraid of. Doing this, talking all about myself and the hardest parts of our life with you, is something I can give back to the world, and I decided just to do it. And I'm glad I did. It's helped me to lay it all out like this. It helped me to see how hard it all is, and how terribly much I love our son. Having a disabled child can be both isolating and an introduction into new networks, and the means of coping with that experience have been systematized over the last few decades. Parenting such a child clarifies the dynamics of a marriage, as it does friendships. For parents who do not have real intimacy with each other or with friends, the going can be tough. Social isolation remained a correlate of less positive mood, more depression, less attachment, one study found. Participating in support groups, advocacy, and medical research can help parents reframe their experiences. Making social connections with their child's caregivers is also helpful. For people who must accept a fixed external reality, the only way forward is to adjust internal reality. Many coping strategies have a Zen simplicity. Instead of resolving chaos, find beauty and happiness amid chaos. I am reminded of a friend who said that when she found out her husband couldn't fill her needs, she changed her needs. They've had a long, good life together. Empathy and compassion work best in concert with the belief that you are still capable of shaping a meaningful life for yourself and your family. The technical term for this is internal locus of control, wherein one determines one's own trajectory, rather than external locus of control, wherein one feels entirely subject to outside circumstances and events. To achieve an internal locus of control, people actively seek to match their lifestyles with their priorities. A mismatch occurs, for example, when a man works 100 hours a week while most valuing his role as a husband or father. Paradoxically, however, parents of disabled children often achieve a feeling of control by making a firm and positive affirmation of their lack of control. The most important thing, often, is a belief in something bigger than one's own experience. The most common source of coherence is religion, but it has many other mechanisms. You can believe in God, in the human capacity for good, in justice, or simply in love. There are many chicken-egg findings here. It's hard to know to what extent positive experiences generate positive perceptions, and to what extent it is the other way around. Aggrandizing the nobility of woe is a coping strategy, but some parents and some disability scholars exalt the catalog of wonders until having a disabled child seems not merely rich in meaning, but almost preferable to other experiences of parenting. The disabled child becomes a glowing family hearth around which all gather in shared song. Such sentimentality can be destructive. It makes parents who are having a rough time feel worse, adding layers of guilt and defeat to their general experience of trouble. It is easier to forgive, however, if one considers the history of intense prejudice against which it reacts. When Max Singer was born, one of his eyes was fixed to the left, and the other had an enlarged pupil. The first neurologist to whom Susanna and Peter Singer took their son referred them to a leading pediatric neurologist in New York. He examined Max, then turned to Peter and said, "You should take your pretty wife home and make yourself another baby, because you're never going to get anything out of this one." "I don't know if he'll ever be able to walk or talk or recognize you or function or even think." The neurologist said that Max had Dandy Walker syndrome, a congenital brain malformation involving the cerebellum and the fluid-filled spaces around it. Other doctors refined the diagnosis. Max had Joubert syndrome, which is a subtype of Dandy Walker. More recent testing has demonstrated that he does not actually have Joubert syndrome, so his current doctor has reverted to the broader Dandy Walker diagnosis. But at this point, Susanna observed, it doesn't really make much difference. Susanna described the day she got the diagnosis as one of the worst of her life. "I'm not sure that we benefited from knowing instantly that there was something wrong," she said. "That slowed down my attachment to him." The Singers next took Max to a neurological ophthalmologist to figure out what was wrong with his eyes. The doctor determined that Max could see. Everything else was open to question. "The first doctor told us he would be a vegetable," Susanna said. "The next one said he could be slightly delayed. We had these diagnoses, but no predictions about what they meant, and were told that we wouldn't know what was going on until autopsy. It's very hard to live without clear expectations." Susanna chose not to discuss Max's problems publicly when he was little. "I didn't know what was going to happen, and I didn't want Max to feel like people knew something about him if, in fact, it wasn't going to be that obvious." Susanna is an art agent who has represented many prominent artists, including Saul LeWitt and Robert Mangold. "I didn't take him around to art world events," she said. "I was keeping him hidden. I regret that secrecy. It was lonely for both of us." When Max was 3 months old, the Singers hired a Trinidadian nanny named Veronica, who stayed with them for the next 20 years. "She was like a third parent, and maybe more than that," Susanna said. "If he had had to choose between us and her, he would have chosen her. She was with him all the time. She never ran out of patience." True to advice, the Singers tried for another baby, but Susanna kept miscarrying. They decided to adopt. While Susanna and Peter were sitting at their chosen adoption agency, they got a call from Veronica saying that Max had come home from school with a fever. Susanna left the meeting so she could take him to the doctor. "Max isn't often sick. Aside from his disabilities, he's actually very healthy. But the agency told us that, really, Max took too much work, and we couldn't give what was needed to another child. They rejected us." "Maybe it would have been difficult for another child to have Max as a brother, but I think both would have benefited a lot." Max can walk if someone has an arm around him and is holding him up. "Unless he decides he doesn't want to," Susanna said, "in which case he will stop and cross his legs, and it is virtually impossible to move him. If he wants to go to a movie or get to a television, he can practically run. Max can use a bathroom, and he has good movement in his left arm and right leg. He can do a lot more than he does," Susanna explained. "He'll wait you out." "Max understands language, but is incapable of producing speech. In many ways, this might seem to be a vast improvement over having neither expressive nor receptive skills. but the mix comes with its own frustrations. To understand and be unable to respond is maddening. Max can nod or shake his head. In hopes that Max might learn to sign, Peter and Susanna went to the American Sign Language Institute for 2 years. It soon became clear that Max lacked the motor control he would need for sign. He can sign more, finished, music, and I'm sorry. He does not like speaking devices, but when he's forced to use a talking machine, something that translates typing or other symbols into sound, he can make fairly complicated sentences. He can read short words. He can write his full name. Max gets a real kick out of almost everything, Susanna said. He's full of curiosity. There's nothing that makes him scared, except very big dogs. He's well-adjusted and feels very loved. Because he goes to a special school, he's never been ostracized or teased. Also, Max doesn't have any physical deformities that make people shy away. That's helped him a lot. I, frankly, was never all that good-looking. But I think he really is. He's extremely affectionate. He doesn't have the muscle control to kiss, but he hugs hard and often. It used to happen all the time that we would sit around with Veronica and Max would put his arm around her. If we were laughing, he'd look at her to make sure she was laughing too. He's very sweet that way. Max went off to a special summer camp for the first time when he was 9, and Susanna phoned the camp every day to check on him. Finally, one of the other campers took the call and offered some friendly advice. Mrs. Singer, Max is having the time of his life. My parents always go away when I'm at camp. Maybe you should consider doing that. Later, Max attended a camp run by the Hebrew Academy for Special Children. The Singers are secular Jews, but summer camps for special needs children are often run by religious organizations. I don't like religion, but I've learned it's not about me, Susanna said. Every year Max goes to that camp, he comes back more mature, and he learns incredible amounts. Max is comparatively well socialized and psychologically independent. When he got on the bus to go to the Special Olympics for the first time, he pushed Susanna away. I was proud of that, she said. From the beginning, I wanted this child to feel like he was the greatest thing in the world. I succeeded in that. Sometimes I wish I hadn't because he can be so arrogant. But I did. She smiled. It is not a joyful thing, by any means, to have a special needs child. But Max, himself, has given us a lot of joy. I had to change my ideas when he was born, about what it means to be successful, for him and for me. His happiness is his success for him, and mine for me. I wish that he would work a little harder at school. I wish he were willing to accomplish more, rather than be satisfied with hanging out. But maybe he would have been that kind of kid anyway. His basic disposition is like mine. Maybe that's why I like it. Buoyant and even, basically happy, and willing to adjust. Max loves Jim Carrey movies, has a sense of humor, and is a classical music enthusiast. My father's a huge opera buff, and I was named Susanna after the marriage of Figaro, Susanna said. Somebody gave me a CD of Cecilia Bartoli, and I put it on, and Max was entranced. Susanna has taken Max to see Cecilia Bartoli at the Metropolitan Opera and at Carnegie Hall. They went to see her give an interview at Hunter College. He has gone to her record signings. He's a groupie, Susanna said. Cecilia Bartoli, who has a dog named Figaro, has, I have to say, been very nice to Max over the years. She signed albums to him. She's even signed a photograph for him. Susanna herself had an old, mean dog who died when Max was 12. Nobody particularly liked him except for me and Max, who loved him like a brother, she said. Max was going off to camp, and I said, Max, I really want a new dog. Is that okay? He kept saying, no, 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 no. Finally, I said, Max, suppose we name it after Cecilia Bartoli. He said, yes. We got the dog, but it was a boy, so the name is Bartoli, and we call him Bart. When I first met the singers, Max was 20. Adolescence is not easy with children like this, Susanna said. This little angel that I once had, I don't have anymore, at least not so much of the time. He loves girls, especially pretty girls, but he's not necessarily appropriate with them. He has friends in a way, but I wouldn't say that they're really bonded together. I know he knows the difference between people like us and himself. He's dependent on everybody. Things had taken a sharp turn for the worse earlier that year, and Peter and Susanna couldn't understand why. Max's behavior became so bad that they took him to a neurologist who put Max on medication that seemed only to make things worse. Eventually they learned that Veronica had been telling Max that she was leaving after the summer. She hadn't yet mentioned this to Susanna or Peter. Max had no way to explain what was wrong. That's one of the hardest things about having a child who can think and react and love and have the feelings we have, but not be able to tell us. I can't even imagine not being able to express such incredible fear and sadness. Once we talked it through, he accepted it. By the time he got back from camp, we had a new person and he's very fond of her. He's adjusted better than I thought, and better than we have. I cried and cried. Veronica's departure was occasioned by her being tired after 20 years, by Max's being so large that he was becoming physically difficult to move, by her wish to return to Trinidad, and by her horror at the thought that Max would someday be moved to a group home. Every time we talked about it, she cried, Susanna said. I kept saying, you know this is the best thing for him. She knew that. I felt like Max should be out of the house around the same time he would have been going to college. I find it sad to see kids in their 40s living with aging parents. I'd like to be around while he's transitioning, to help him, so when something happens to Peter and me, he isn't suddenly thrown into chaos. It can be hard to find a place that can deal with someone who is as physically disabled as Max, but where staff are prepared to talk to him, even though he can't speak, and to cope with the depth of his understanding. His parents eventually found a place that seemed right, but it was still under construction when I met them, and they were waiting. Susanna is matter-of-fact about the group home. It's not going to feel like a big void when he goes. It doesn't when he's in camp. Peter and I get along better when Max is away. We don't have help on weekends, and if Peter plays golf all day one day, that means I have to be with Max all day. Peter has the same problem if I need to do something. I don't believe that we'll have an empty nest problem. I think that would have been very different with a normal child. So I get sad about not being sad. I have heard mothers of healthy children express a fantasy of the child who would be forever tender and vulnerable and dependent, who would not go through the rebellion of adolescence or the detachment of adulthood. Be careful what you wish for. Disabled children are forever the responsibility of their parents. 85% of people with mental retardation live with or under the supervision of their parents, an arrangement that remains common until the parent becomes disabled or dies. This can cause the parents terrible anxiety as they age. It can also give them a permanent sense of purpose. Some parents who begin with gusto become overwhelmed by children who require special attention and, in midlife or later, begin to despair. Others who had originally wanted to give up their children for adoption fall gradually in love with them. The life expectancy for people with disabilities is increasing. In the 1930s, the average age at death for institutionalized mentally retarded males was about 15, and for females, about 22. By 1980, the figure for males was 58, and for females it was up to 60, though people without mobility die younger. For the parents, before the routines are learned, the emotional bond is made, and the fantasy of the imagined healthy child has been lamented, the initial stress is often overwhelming. Within a diverse sample of aging parents of developmentally disabled adult children, however, one research group found that nearly two-thirds felt their continuing role as caregivers gave them a sense of purpose, while more than half felt less lonely with their child still at home. In 1994, Bill Zirinsky and Ruth Schechter, owners of Crazy Wisdom Bookstore in Ann Arbor, Michigan, welcomed their first child, a red-haired boy whom they named Sam. He had a healthy birth, but things fell off over the next few months. Sam had no appetite, poor muscle tone, and wasn't reaching normal developmental milestones. He couldn't sit or roll over. At first, his pediatrician thought he might have a virus, but at 6 months, neurological and endocrine testing showed that Sam had a grave disorder. The pediatrician said he had a hunch that Sam would have a short lifespan, that his illness might be degenerative, that he might have demyelination of his nervous system, which can damage sensation, cognition, and movement, and that he would probably be vegetable-like. The information was dropped, as Ruth described it, like a lead balloon. Bill and Ruth devoted all of their energy to finding out what was wrong. "For 6 months, we had thought our son was just developing slowly," Bill said. "In one weekend, we had to deal with learning he was on a completely different life path." They contacted pediatrician after pediatrician, only to be told that they were mistakenly reaching well baby doctors. Finally, Ruth called one of the pediatricians on her list and described her son to the nurse, who said, "Dr. Weinblatt loves these kind of cases." They next made their way to the neurologist who would be with them for the long haul, Daryl DeVivo, at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. Bill remembered, when we asked him, "Is Sam likely to have a normal life? Is it still possible?" Dr. DeVivo said gently, "It would appear that that won't be the case." I knew that we were dealing with something that was not going to be remedied. Bill's older sister has cerebral palsy, so he felt he had been trained to take care of a disabled child. Ruth said, "It would have been different if he'd been diagnosed at birth. All the bonding in those first 6 months was critical. I was so committed to him by then. I remember very clearly, in those weeks right after, wondering whether I would ever feel joy again, and wanting to sacrifice my own life for his, knowing I would gladly give up everything if he would be okay. Those were two really profound and totally new feelings for me." Sam would never walk, talk, eat, or hear. He received nutrition via a gastric feeding tube, G-tube, was in a wheelchair, and had a seizure disorder. At the age of nearly 10, he weighed only 32 pounds. He suffered from constant reflux and pain. His condition was determined to be an undiagnosable degenerative neurometabolic disorder. There were relatives who, over the years, might meet or hear about Sam, Bill said. Their conception of Sam was, quote, vegetable, kind of a 1950s idea, Many more friends and relatives didn't always get him, but understood that there was more than meets the eye to him. Then there's the 20% of our friends who really spent time with Sam and got to know him, who would look in his eyes, then play a game or read a book with him. Sam was a mirror for how people understood consciousness. People asked Ruth whether she thought he knew who she was, and she explained that he knew who many people were. Sam loved visual things. He loved being in the water. He loved therapeutic riding. "He puts a smile on his face when he's riding a horse," Bill said. "When he is feeling good, it's really rich." Among the family photos of Sam are the wedding photos of one of his childcare providers. She had asked Sam to be the ring bearer in her wedding, and there he was, strapped into his wheelchair and holding the rings on a velvet cushion. "He had a horrible weekend," Ruth said. "He had a lot of seizures, and we had to really drug him. But when it came time for him to go down the aisle, he totally pulled himself together and looked radiant. I feel he understood that the ceremony was something special." Because Sam's disorder was unknown, the risk of a recurrence could not be predicted. After he turned 4, Bill and Ruth decided to try for a second child. Juliana seemed healthy at first, but at about 4 months, the not eating well pattern started. In her 5th month, Ruth and Bill brought her to Dr. Weinblatt. "When I first met the family, Juliana was almost 7, and her disorder was somewhat milder than Sam's. She was severely hearing impaired, not deaf. She could walk, though not far and with great difficulty. Instead of having a G-tube surgically inserted through the abdomen into the stomach, she received nourishment through a less invasive nasal gastric tube, which Ruth had learned to insert whenever Juliana pulled it out. Juliana did not have a seizure disorder, and her health seemed less tentative than Sam's. Like Sam, she was tiny. Though she was 7 when I met her, she looked perhaps 2. She is a fairy sprite, Bill said. A delightful and funny little girl from another planet. Like Sam, she is very sensitive and has continued to develop emotionally, even while her cognitive development is limited. Their emotional response to many things is age-appropriate. Love, jealousy, excitement, attachment, sadness, compassion, desire, hope. Ruth had more of a sense that the children weren't going to live for long than Bill did. Though Juliana seemed stable, Sam's illness was clearly progressive, and his life became steadily more difficult. In an average week, he would be good 2 days. 3 days he would have some hours when his stomach hurt, or he had mild seizures, or he would need to throw up. And 2 days he'd be disconsolate and have to be held much of the day. "I really wanted people to understand that our lives weren't utterly miserable," Ruth said. "Sam was beautiful to me, and continued to be beautiful to me. I can't fault somebody for giving up a child like Sam or Juliana. It's a very tall order. But I never wanted to." They had all spent summers on Long Island with Bill's parents in a house by the sea, and as Sam's condition deteriorated, they contacted a local pediatrician. The pediatrician mentioned that while it's easy to let a child go by refusing life support in New York, it's extremely difficult to disconnect a child once he has been connected. They were furious at her. "We felt violated by it," Bill said. "She didn't understand that we thought Sam wanted to be here in this world." Bill and Ruth went for a long walk, and Ruth said that she thought Sam would tell them what to do. By anybody else's standards, he was already living an incredibly impaired life, Ruth said. But we had spent 9 years with him, and knew he could have pleasure, feel love, enjoy his environment, get a kick out of going to school. If that was still true, then I felt it was unfair to let him go. A few years earlier, Bill and Ruth had decided to adopt a child, and Sam's escalating illness coincided with the notification that a daughter had been found for them. One of them had to go to Guatemala when the adoption was finalized. They kept putting it off, but Sam had been in the hospital for 35 days, and their new daughter was waiting. So Bill and Ruth agreed that Bill would wait at the hospital while Ruth went to Guatemala. It was really hard to go, Ruth said, but he waited. He died the day after I returned. When I visited Bill and Ruth 2 years after Sam had died, they were on Long Island again. Age 2, Leela, their adopted daughter, was already bigger than Juliana, who at 7 weighed 22 pounds. Pre-adoption, social workers had expressed concern that a normal child would struggle in their household, but that did not appear to be the case. The way we love Leela is just different, Ruth said. I'm constantly juggling those two things, and feeling like Juliana is getting short shrift because Leela is such a magnet for people's attention. She's verbal, she's interactive, she's loads of fun. But then, am I paying too much attention to Juliana? There's no easy path. Bill said, many people pay a lot of attention to Leela. Juliana watches. She's constantly measuring and evaluating every bit of it. It's painful to us sometimes to watch her watching as people pay so much attention to her sister. Unlike Sam, Juliana was not confined to a wheelchair, and her diminutive size seemed congruous with her cognitive deficits. What would have been odd in a girl who looked like a 7-year-old was less odd in a girl who appeared to be not yet 2. Aside from the nasal feeding tube, she didn't look unusual. Bill and Ruth waited until she was out of earshot to say that they had no idea how long she would live. I asked whether she could understand speech. Bill recounted reading aloud his notes on Sam's death when the family visited a neurologist. Juliana suddenly began to cry. Juliana's response wasn't necessarily receptive language, but it's receptive something, Bill said. It's receptivity to her parents' feelings or the vibrational field. We're both sensitive to not talking in front of her about things that might upset her, just the way you wouldn't with a kid who is more obviously cognitively normal. Just in case. Juliana died 2 years after my day in Long Island, at about the same age as Sam. Her condition had deteriorated, and before she died she lost the ability to walk, then most of the rest of her motor control, and was eventually unable to sit up. Yet one senses that Juliana is not entirely discontented about her path, Bill wrote in an email. She is frustrated at times, and she cries sometimes when she feels sorry for herself. Yet there has descended upon her a certain wisdom and meditative resignation, which is very becoming. Meanwhile, she does suffer physically, and that is painful for her and us. When I praised the quality of care he was giving to her, he wrote, I think most people I know, if a child had been given to them who was profoundly disabled, would have risen to the occasion. I need to believe that. It's how I construct a good world. After she died, Bill said, I would have chosen the easier path. But now, knowing what I know, I would want Sam again, and I would want Juliana again. How could I trade the love I experienced with these two human beings? I was closer to Sam than any human being in my life. I spent more time lying on a bed with him, looking in his eyes, than anyone I've ever been with. I've spent a huge amount of time with Juliana, just hanging out with her, just loving her. So that's like asking any parent whether they would trade the love that they know for some abstract, better child. I would do it all again. Ruth reached over and took Bill's hand with a look of deep compassion. I actually think it's not believing in God that has given us that perspective. People always regale us with these little sayings like, God doesn't give you any more than you can handle. But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen. Siblings of severely disabled children have been studied extensively but with inconclusive results. One study mentions that persons with disabled siblings felt that living with a disabled brother or sister helped them be more responsible, be more tolerant, better able to see the good in others, develop a better sense of humor, and be more flexible. However, these siblings also reported embarrassment, guilt, isolation, and concern about the future of their disabled sibling. Another study of siblings of disabled children pitted clinical diagnosis of depression against plain old feeling bad, and found that while siblings of those with disabilities were in general more unhappy, they did not suffer from more diagnosable psychiatric problems than their peers. Often, the more obvious or severe the handicap, the easier it is for the non-disabled sibling, because the child does not present in a way that causes people to anticipate normal behavior. Children who seem normal at first, and then turn out not to be, require more explaining. The worst disabilities seem to be associated with the best sibling adjustment. This result seems closely tied to the entire family's greater clarity about, and comfort with, a visible defect in the child, one study noted. Another observed that a diagnosis made a huge difference to younger siblings, who could use a simple explanation with friends. Those with a sibling with no clear diagnosis had to struggle more. The reason most commonly given for institutionalizing children in the heyday of institutionalization was that keeping a disabled child at home was unfair to healthy siblings, because the disabled child would take too much of the parent's energy and focus and embarrass the non-disabled child. More recent work shows that healthy siblings are often disturbed when parents institutionalize. Alan Shawn's book, Twin, details the pain he experienced when his sister was sent away. The interests of the non-disabled sibling are now more often held to require keeping the disabled sibling at home. This may be better for the disabled child as well, but it's striking how the conversation continues to prioritize the interest of the non-disabled sibling over that of the disabled one. John and Eve Morris were a love story from the moment they met at a party at Cornell, where they were both undergraduates. They married young and moved to San Diego. I didn't want to be with anybody else, even children, because I loved him so much, Eve said. Not until Eve was 30 did she commit to pregnancy. I also didn't want to give up my freedom, she said. As it turned out, I liked being a mother much more than I ever liked freedom. Eve and John chose as their obstetrician a devout Mormon who was appalled by the local hospital's cesarean rate of 1 in 5 births. Before Alex's delivery, he told John and Eve that he didn't think nature screwed up that much. They warmed to his enthusiasm. When Eve went into labor, she was given an external fetal heart monitor. Doctors who later reviewed her monitor strip said it suggested distress and that Eve should have had an immediate cesarean, but their doctor seems not to have noticed. By the time Eve delivered, Alex was essentially dead. Her Apgar scores were 0, and she was an alarming dark purple color. She was whisked away to the neonatal intensive care unit, NICU. The dream of normal parenthood shattered there before my eyes, John said. Immediately following the birth, The doctors were careful not to offer conclusions about Alex's condition. Perhaps because dire news can interfere with parental bonding. Perhaps due to liability concerns. Perhaps because they could not predict the extent and severity of her problems. Although they may immediately have recognized cerebral palsy, the diagnosis was not communicated to Eve and John until many months later. Cerebral palsy is any disability caused by damage to the cerebrum before birth, just afterward, or in the first 3 years of life. It comes in many shapes and sizes, with a broad range of possible motor impairments. As an infant, Alex screamed whenever Eve tried to feed her, choking on the milk, because her throat was constantly raw from reflux. But the Morrises did not yet understand the extent of Alex's disability. It took us a long time to confront the idea that anything had gone wrong in a big way, John said. Eve said, I'd been a cheerleader. I'd done well at school and gotten into Cornell. I had parents who loved me and were never abusive. I'd had a life of things going right, and somehow it was hard to think that everything wasn't still going right. Those habits kept me in denial for a long, long time. By the time I faced what was wrong with Alex, I loved her more than anything in the world. John is a lawyer with some background in liability. He and Eve initiated a lawsuit against the doctor and hospital when Alex was 18 months old. After 2 years, they arrived at a settlement, which included a lump sum payment and a court-supervised annuity. The annuity is closely monitored. John and Eve must file annual expense reports. They immediately bought a customized running stroller and a wheelchair van, then hired a young woman named Erica Lundeen as a part-time caretaker for Alex. Erica was never exactly a daughter to us, and never just a friend, and never just someone who worked for us, John said. She was all of the above. When I met Erica, she was newly married. Alex had been her bridesmaid, dressed up and wheeled down the aisle for the occasion. We will do anything to keep her in our lives, Eve said. I want her to have kids, and then I'll start taking care of her kids. Keep it going. Erica lives a mile away in a house that John and Eve own. You remember It Takes a Village, John said? I'm trying to build a village, so there will always be second and third layers of people who are familiar with Alex. When Alex was 2, John and Eve had a son, Dylan, named for his father's favorite singer, and Dylan's genial, healthy, enthusiastic persona has mitigated his parents' pain somewhat. My advice is to have another kid, Eve said, so you know what it feels like to have it how it's supposed to be. Their major undertaking, accomplished with their own savings and some of Alex's lump sum, was to build their own house in the Point Loma area of San Diego. Designed by Eve herself, the house sits on a hill with a view of the ocean. The corridors and turns are wide enough to accommodate a wheelchair. A big swing hangs at one end of the living room. The sensation of motion is among Alex's chief joys. A hot tub on the roof goes mostly unused now because it has become too difficult to lift Alex in and out of it. But when she was younger, she loved it. She has her own fully equipped bathroom, an ergonomic bedroom with a built-in bed she can't fall out of, and a sensory area full of fountains, lights, sounds, and vibrations she can trigger if she hits a button, which she does only by chance. The house is beautiful but not showy, capacious and welcoming and utilitarian, with an honest, handmade feel to it. The beams are exposed tree trunks, and the kitchen cabinet doors are made from willow twigs Eve gathered near her mother's house. The house also represents a resignation to hard facts. By the time she was six, we acknowledge that this is who and what she is, and what her condition is, and it's not going to change, Eve said. We stopped doing specific physical therapies, trying to teach her new stuff. Early on, Eve joined a mother's group of women with CP children, but she has never been to a therapist. When we started the lawsuit, I sometimes wished she had died, Eve said. So I was thinking about seeing a therapist. But when you initiate a lawsuit here, they can requisition your talks with your therapist, and I did not want anybody to know that I had felt those things. I grew up in a WASP neighborhood, and everyone was supposed to be the same and act in set ways. I have a really easy time at home with her, but we never go out to dinner as a family because of how unpredictable she is. When John has friends over, or when there's a birthday party, or when I see my parents, I want her to be her best. I wanted her to be her best for you, even. Eve looked doleful. I feel so much sadness sometimes. When my friends are talking about their girls being mean, I catch myself saying, I'm glad I don't have a girl. I do have a girl, but she's almost this other being. No one understands what it's like. Even I know what it's like right now, and that's all. When you came to interview us, I thought, well, I'm very happy to talk to you so long as you promise not to ask about the past or the future, because the present is the only thing I've got down. When I met the Morrises, they had recently drafted an estate plan naming Erica as guardian for both kids. At 25, Dylan would assume primary legal responsibility for Alex, though the lawsuit annuity will always provide sufficient income to hire a caregiver. Eve has tremendous apprehension around Dylan's future role. I don't want him to have to play the role that John plays now, she said. At 16, Dylan maintained that he loved his sister and would always be glad to care for her. I don't think she's ever missed a baseball game, he told me. I was born into this. It's affected me all my life. Dylan's coach said that he knew Dylan must have a connection to a disabled kid because he had never seen such maturity in someone who hadn't done some difficult caretaking. Eve has consistently opposed having a G-tube surgically implanted in Alex. Alex, 18 when I met her, has managed without one, though she needs to be fed every 4 hours to prevent reflux. Alex's impairments are unusually severe for cerebral palsy. All of the other CP children of the women in Eve's mother's group can walk, and all have at least rudimentary speech. One is attending college, and another has a job bagging groceries at a local supermarket. Blessings are frequently mixed, John said. Those kids recognize how they don't fit, that they don't have boyfriends or girlfriends, that kids laugh at them. Nobody ever teased Alex. She is so profoundly disabled and helpless that even the worst little snotty 4-year-old never snickered at her. As for us, we have to think about seizures, but not about her smoking pot behind the school. The fundamental role of the parent is the same: to provide for and love and give the best opportunity you can to your kids on any given day. I think we do that with Alex the same as we do with Dylan. John and Eve have become habituated to their daughter's needs. What was once self-conscious has become intuitive. Alex is medically more stable than she has ever been. At the same time, her growth has made it impossible for the family to do things they used to enjoy, to take her swimming or to carry her around the house. The work of getting her in and out of bed or on and off the toilet has become especially difficult as John and Eve have grown older. It's emotionally gotten easier, even while it's physically gotten harder, Eve said. The qualities of helplessness that read as innocence in an infant seem incongruous in someone whose body is adult size. The uncontrolled tongue, the flailing limbs, the stretching and turning body, the bunched-up muscles. Involuntary movements notwithstanding, Alex is always impeccably groomed. I put nail polish on her, and keep her hair long, and dress her in pretty clothes, so people will have something to say, Eve explained. They come over and say, look how nice your fingernails are, instead of having to talk about what's wrong with her. For Eve, the most burdensome thing is the sympathy that so often supersedes connection. I hate the look of pity, the people who say, you're such a good mom. Staying with the Morrises for a week, I was overwhelmed by how much they had to do, and how little they let it get in their way. John is a habitual runner, and Alex loves the sensation of the wind in her face, so he pushes her in a lightweight stroller for 5 miles every day. Eve takes her for wheelchair outings on the wharf. Every year, Eve makes a Halloween costume for Alex that incorporates her wheelchair. One year, she was an alien in a foreign spacecraft. Another year, an ice cream truck. And most recently, a Krispy Kreme donut distribution center. Eve trained as an artist, and the costumes are marvelous. John and Eve have a fairly equitable distribution of parenting. John is more resilient, and Eve is more attuned. It doesn't hurt him when she cries, Eve said one afternoon. He can lie down next to her, and she can be crying for 15 minutes, and he's just keeping her company. And I'm trying to fix it. When it can be fixed, Eve explained, her anxiety is useful, but most of the time it can't, and John's serenity serves a more vital function. Eve takes care of Alex's personal hygiene, including bathing her every other day, while John feeds her most of her meals when he's home. Alex cannot choose solid food, and she cannot swallow liquids without a risk of choking. 5 times a day, John gives her a high-protein nutritional supplement mixed with rice cereal and sometimes flavored with a dollop of baby food. Every morning, John and Eve rise at 5:30 to get Alex ready for school. It takes about 40 minutes to wake and dress her. Then she needs to be fed. The school bus arrives at 6:30. It would be easier for them to drive her, but they want her to experience the social atmosphere on the bus. When Alex turned 18, her HMO switched her out of the pediatric system. So when I visited, Eve was taking her to a new GP, a new neurologist, and so on. A few days later, a wheelchair outfitter came to visit, and there was a family session to look over Alex's current chair and decide how it needed to be modified to serve her better. It took just over 3 hours to order the new chair. Eve kept a diary through Alex's early years, but she has never gone back to read it. John said, "We remember all the things we hoped she would do one day, all the hours of physical therapy teaching her to turn over voluntarily, to raise up her head." Eve recounted a recent conversation in which the orthopedist told her that in later life, swallowing gets difficult again, and Alex might eventually need a G-tube. Eve said, "I thought we were at the stage that Alex wouldn't really get better, wouldn't get worse. You never get to relax." John agreed. "I've been invited a number of times to be on the board of the local United Cerebral Palsy," he said. "You know how people say, I give it the office? I give it home." But on the other hand, if any parent could ask for just one thing for their child, what would it be? Not that they go to Harvard, but that they be happy. Alex is happy most of the time. So if I'd had only one wish, that's what it would have been, and I'd have gotten it. The field of profound disabilities does not often have breaking scandals, but the Ashley treatment rocked that world. Ashley X, whose last name has never been revealed, was born in 1997, an apparently healthy baby. When she seemed irritable at about 3 months, her parents thought it was colic. It turned out to be static encephalopathy, a diagnosis that, like CP, describes a stable brain injury of unknown origin. It has left Ashley with limited functioning. She will never talk, walk, or feed herself, and she cannot turn over. She can sleep, wake, and breathe. And she can smile. In a bid to defend his own and his family's privacy, her father has refused to meet face-to-face with anyone from the media. He refers to himself as A.D., Ashley's dad. He explained to me over the phone that he and his wife had initially resisted giving Ashley a G-tube because they had a visceral negative response to the idea of surgery. "She cannot chew, and she was always struggling with the bottle," he said. "We would spend 6 to 8 hours a day to get enough nutrition to her. Finally, they had a tube inserted." Despite compromised brain function, Ashley is not unresponsive. "Ashley enjoys our company and voices," her parents said in a written statement. "When we sweet talk to her, she often radiates with a big smile. She enjoys rich music, walks outdoors, a swim on a warm day, the swing, etc." Ashley's parents started to call her their pillow angel because she was generally lying on a pillow and never gave them trouble. They have proposed the term be used for other people with MSD. As Ashley grew from infancy to childhood, her care became more challenging. Hourly, her parents change her position and prop her back on her pillow. "We make sure she is well covered and pull her shirt down to cover her tummy. We wipe her drool, etc.," AD explained to me. "Also, there are diaper changes, tube feedings, dressing, bathing, teeth cleaning, stretching, entertainment." All of this became harder as Ashley grew larger. "You start having difficulty including her in activities," AD said to me. "You want to be able to carry her, but your body aches." The notion formed gradually that her added size and weight were her worst enemy, and the idea to do something about it was an epiphany. When Ashley was 6, her mother, A.M., was talking to her own mother, who reminded her of a neighbor who had had hormone treatments to prevent her becoming extremely tall. This procedure was not uncommon in the 1950s, when girls over 5 feet 10 inches were considered unattractive. Ashley's pediatrician suggested that A.D. and A.M. visit Dr. Daniel Gunther, an endocrinologist at Seattle Children's Hospital. At their appointment several weeks later, Gunther acknowledged that Ashley's growth could be attenuated by administering estrogen, which would close her growth plates. "Since Ashley will cry for an hour when she sneezes because she is so upset by slight discomfort, AD thought she would have a hard time with menstruation and the cramping it can cause. He proposed a hysterectomy. He thought breasts would get in her way when she was turned on her pillow or strapped in a wheelchair, and asked that his daughter's breast buds, the small, almond-shaped glands that enlarge into breasts at puberty, be removed. All this would result in a person who was easier to move, which in turn, he argued, would mean better circulation, digestion, and muscle condition for her, and fewer sores and infections. Giving Ashley a permanent child's figure would leave her with what her father called a body that more closely matched her stage of mental development. A.M. and A.D. had to persuade the hospital ethics committee that this was a viable set of procedures, and A.D. put together a PowerPoint presentation for that purpose. The Ethics Committee devoted a great deal of time to the question. There were two main aspects to the parents' requests, said Dr. Douglas D.